Hello, and welcome back into another episode of the Big Ten Blitz presented by the Floor Slap. I'm your host, Sean. And slowly but surely, we are inching our way through the college football offseason with spring ball already starting to kick off across the country. So that's going to take up the bulk of our episode today, doing another batch of Big Ten spring storylines. Part two out of three, going school by school, really what to watch for in spring practice, what position group, what area that's going to dictate how successful they are, all these teams, in 2024. But before we get into Big Ten spring storylines, have news across the Big Ten and across college football with some new coaching changes, rumored changes to the college football playoff, as well as other news and headlines from a few schools in the Big Ten. So got a lot to get through today in another episode of the Big Ten Blitz, and can't wait to dive in. So a lot of news and headlines across college football in the last few weeks. And the first headline that I want to talk about in this episode of the Big Ten Blitz is a splash hire, a splash coaching hire that really went under the radar and didn't get a whole lot of national recognition. And that was Eric Bieniemy going to UCLA to be their offensive coordinator. And my first reaction when I heard this was a jaw to the floor, like, for a couple of reasons. First, it's almost an illogical move for Eric Bieniemy to go from being an offensive coordinator that was routinely in conversation for head coaching hires in the NFL to then go to a Big Ten offensive coordinator, and not just a college football offensive coordinator for a big-time school, but a program like UCLA, who's in full rebuild mode and just lost, you know, their signature head coach. So it's a jarring move at the surface level. But also, I was surprised because it felt like an absolute slam dunk for UCLA. So I wanted to go into Eric Bieniemy's background a little bit more and just try to figure out exactly what he could be bringing to this UCLA offense in 2024. And obviously, he had that huge run with Kansas City, and Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes got them a couple Super Bowl titles and routinely was running the NFL's most electric offense. And that's really the biggest headline on his resume is his stint in Kansas City, but went back a little bit before then because, honestly, I don't think a lot of people knew how Eric Bieniemy really was up until the past 6 years or so. And so Eric Bieniemy was a UCLA's running back coach from 2003 to 2005, and he was Colorado's offensive coordinator and play caller from 2011 to 2012. That's his prior college experience. And I looked back into his last stint as a college offensive coordinator with Colorado, and it was a lot messier than I would have thought. In 2011, Colorado averaged 20 points per game. That was 109th nationally. They had 346 total yards per game. That was 92nd nationally. But he was there for a second year, so I figured, I'm sure they stepped it up in year two. But in Colorado in 2012, they averaged 17.8. points per game on offense. That was 120th nationally and only 303 yards per game total on offense. That's 119th nationally in 2012. So the offense got, what was already a really bad offense got substantially worse in his second year running it. And then he ended up going to Kansas City that year after and worked his way up to be offensive coordinator there. And it's also worth mentioning that Colorado had 4 wins total in his 2 years there as their offensive coordinator and play caller. And then I also took a deeper look at his stints with Washington, because obviously he left the Chiefs to go be the Commanders' offensive coordinator this past season. And the Commanders in 2022, they were 24th in the NFL in scoring offense and 20th in total offense. In 2023, when Eric Bieniemy got there, they actually got worse. They became 25th in the NFL in scoring offense and 24th in total offense. And that was really jarring for me. I felt like at the beginning of the NFL season, the Commanders had some momentum. Sam Howell looked a bit like a gunslinger type, and it looked like Eric Bieniemy was elevating that offense. But then as, you know, the Commanders fell out of the playoff race, obviously people stopped talking about them later into the season, as usually happens with the Commanders. And I kind of lost sight of how mediocre that offense really was. And, you know, listen, you have to recognize that Colorado job was a long time ago. Over 10 years ago now, and it was in a really dark period for that Colorado program. And Eric Bieniemy has certainly grown a lot and learned a lot in the past 12 years. And he's definitely a better offensive mind and offensive coordinator now than he was back then. And neither of those situations with Colorado or with the Commanders were great. Both were difficult jobs. So we have to get that out of the way. But being devil's advocate, I do think it's a red flag that Colorado's offense got worse in Eric Bieniemy's second season. And that was also the last time that Eric Bieniemy was primary play caller, at least until this past year with Washington. And, you know, like I said, in his lone season with Washington, the offense actually got worse, despite having a much improved defense from 2022. It certainly was not an elite defense what the Commanders had, but it was an improved unit, and they didn't take a step forward with Eric Bieniemy. It just kind of got me thinking that, you know, maybe there was a reason that Eric Bieniemy had all of those head coaching job interviews. It seemed for a couple year stretch, every single vacant NFL job that opened, Eric Bieniemy was at least rumored to be tied to. And every single offseason for a few years, though, he was expressing his desire to be an NFL head coach very publicly. And like I said before, he was the offensive coordinator for consistently the best offense in the NFL year over year, and yet never got an offer. And in the moment, it felt like Eric Bieniemy's exclusion was really blamed on the race issue, which is certainly a legitimate problem in pro sports. But we have had four minority head coaching hires this offseason. Now, 9 out of the 32 head coaches are minorities. Probably still not enough. Oh, certainly plenty of coaches that don't even have the experience that Eric Bieniemy has have had their opportunities in the past couple seasons. So I don't think it was really Eric Bieniemy's race or ethnicity that was the reason he didn't get those head coaching offers. I think it's becoming more and more evident that his lack of head coaching offers probably had to do with his coaching and or leading ability. You know, after all, he was given a lot of credit for Kansas City's success while having maybe the greatest quarterback talent the sport has ever seen and one of the greatest offensive minds in the history of football in Andy Reid at head coach, who, by the way, was their primary play caller, not Eric Bieniemy. So exactly how much of Kansas City's development, creativity, and just overall success that they've seen on the offensive side of the ball under Andy Reid, you know, how much of that can be credited to Eric Bieniemy is really hard to say. And I think the further we get removed from that stint in Kansas City and seeing what they're able to accomplish without him, while seeing what Eric Bieniemy is accomplishing without Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes, I think it's starting to become evident that maybe a lot of people gave Eric Bieniemy a little bit too much credit for what was going on with the Chiefs. So the point of what I'm trying to get at here is when I first heard this news, as curious of a move as it was for Eric Bieniemy, I thought it was a terrific hire for UCLA. They certainly lose a lot from last year with Dante Moore and Chip Kelly gone, but they have some nice weapons on the offensive side of the bar. They have wide receiver J. Michael Sturdivant. They have a nice running back in T.J. Harden and a nice veteran tight end in Maliki Motivayo. So they have some weapons there, and I thought maybe Eric Bieniemy would be able to maximize that talent, find some ways to generate explosive plays for this offense, and keep UCLA relevant this season. But the more I think about it, and the more you really reflect on Eric Bieniemy's coaching career, as great as it's been for the most part, maybe this isn't as much of a slam dunk hire for UCLA as I was originally giving them credit for. Let's get one thing straight. Is this a bad hire by UCLA? Absolutely not. They're bringing in someone with 20 plus years of coaching experience at the college and pro level, who has multiple Super Bowl wins. And he's spent over a decade with one of the greatest offensive minds the sport's ever seen in Andy Reid. No matter how you twist, that's a good hire for UCLA, and that's going to be a net positive for them in 2024. But at this point in the offseason, you know, we're still just entering spring ball, still have another whole batch of the transfer portal to get through after spring ball concludes. So we're still very early on in the offseason. But at this point, I'm projecting UCLA to be one of the bottom teams in the Big Ten. I'd be pretty surprised if they're able to get to a bowl game this season. And so when I first heard this news about Eric Bieniemy, I thought maybe this could be the hire, the piece that they needed to maybe have a sneaky good season in 2024. But reflecting on this a little bit more now, I don't think that hiring Eric Bieniemy is the difference maker they needed to tip the scale and make this maybe a 6, 7, 8 win team. I think 4 or 5 teams wins is more likely for UCLA in 2024, despite the hire of Eric Bieniemy. But that wasn't the only news that we've seen across college football. Before we get into a couple other coaching changes that we've seen, some changes in the broader landscape of college football. One of the things that have come out in the past couple weeks that the NCAA is voting on adding headset communication to the coaches and quarterbacks. next season. A vote hasn't come in yet, but you got to figure that's going to be almost a near unanimous approval for college football athletic directors. And this is just a no-brainer. And I cannot understate how great this is for college football moving forward. Forget the sign-stealing stuff and everything that's been associated with adding headset communication to the college level. This is just going to enable offenses to communicate more efficiently and move faster. And I think part of what makes college football so exciting is the flurry of points and how we can see each team get close to 10 possessions sometimes. And it's just a lot, almost faster pace than the pro level. And so I think part of that got taken away from us last season with the clock no longer stopping after every single first down. So I think this streamlined communication is going to maybe get some even more tempo into the college level. And I think it's going to be really great, really fun to watch, overall great for college football. On top of that, as I'm sure everyone has seen by now, there's already talks of another college football playoff expansion. Not even a year into this new 12-team format, we haven't even seen the transition from 4 to 12 through all the way, and there's already talk about going to 14 teams in 2026 when that new deal would have to be renewed. And so I have to say one thing, and I'm sure, I mean, this is kind of a dicey topic right now, but I'm vehemently against further expansion. Like I said, we haven't even seen 12 teams with our own eyes to determine how it's working, if it's an improvement from four, if it's too many teams, if it's just right. It's impossible to say right now. We have zero sample size. We don't know the quality of college football that we're getting out of this change. And in my opinion, again, we have to see how this plays out on the field over the next couple seasons. But I think we're in a sweet spot right now with balancing having an expanded playoff and keeping the meaningfulness of the regular season and how important that is on a week-to-week basis. Because I think we're at a point right now where there's going to be a lot of different representation in the playoff because we have seven at-large bids and one spot for the group of five. But at the same time, we're not losing the meaning of the regular season because conference title races. I think the conferences are overall more competitive, so we're going to see conference races still come down to just one game, and winning that conference championship and getting an automatic bid into the playoff, getting that bye, is so important. College football regular season is still going to be very important, especially when you consider three losses is all going to eliminate every single team. That's a far cry from where we were in college football 15 years ago, where one loss nearly eliminated you. But it's still a balancing act. Like, you know, the goal is now to get to 10 wins to be able to throw your hat into the playoff picture. So I think we're at a really good point of balancing what we want to see, and that's an expanded playoff where more teams get a chance to compete for the national championship, but not losing how great the college football regular season is, because it's a slippery slope, and that's the bottom line. I don't have necessarily a problem with going from 12 to 14. Difference is kind of negligible. If anything, I might like 14 a little bit more because I like the idea of there only being two byes instead of four. Makes those top two conference championship slots a lot more valuable, can make the race a lot more interesting. But it's what happens after we go from 12 to 14 already without seeing the product of a 12-team playoff. Because if we go to 14 so quickly, I feel like going to 16, 18, 20, 24, I feel like that's inevitable. And at that point, college football will be ruined. And so that's why the expansion talk makes me nervous. 12 to 14 is fine. I'm concerned about the slope that this is going down. And on top of there being, you know, talk about college football playoff expansion already, obviously the Big Ten and SEC are really heading those discussions because they know that they have all the leverage in the world. They have all the viewership eyeballs on them, and they know the college football playoff needs them more than they need the playoff. Because at the end of the day, if the Big Ten and SEC, you know, run off and say, we're making our own playoff because we don't like how this is going, you know, everyone will be watching the Big Ten and SEC playoff, and everyone in the court of public opinion will be deeming that champion of college football. That's just the way it works, and I don't think that's any secret at all. So with this playoff expansion talk now, the Big Ten and SEC are saying, hey, we want those two automatic bye weeks, and we want more automatic bids than the rest of you, because we know that we deserve it, because our conferences are so great and they're so deep. So the proposal, at least that's floating out there right now, is that or what the Big Ten and SEC are proposing is that their champions would get the 1 and 2 seed, the two bye weeks. They would also be guaranteed two at-large bids. And then the ACC and Big 12 would have their conference champion, and they would only get one at-large bid. And then the group of five would have one spot, and the rest would be made up of at-large bids from, you know, any conference. So my opinion on this is, you know, it kind of is just me being, you know, grumpy at changing college football, I suppose, but I'm kind of against automatic bids in the playoff that aren't conference champions. And I'm also against, you know, the Big Ten and the SEC getting automatic buys. I think things can change so much year to year, and I want to avoid situations where mediocre teams get automatic bids into the playoff and take away a spot from a really deserving team just because they play in a perceived tougher conference. And that conference, you know, had to fill their allotted spots for the playoff. Because guess what? You know, the Big Ten and SEC, you know, they are undoubtedly the best conferences in college football. But they should have to prove that on the field. Because it happens sometimes, conferences have down years. And I love Big Ten representation in the playoff, but if it comes down to 1 year and 8-4, I don't know, Michigan State getting into the playoff because the Big Ten had a down year and that was our third best team, I don't think that's good for college football, and I don't even think that's good for the Big Ten. I would rather see that go to a team that truly deserved, earned it throughout the college football regular season. Now, if we are going down this route and you're going to make me choose between the Big Ten and SEC getting automatic buys or them getting more bids than the Big 12 and the ACC, I'm really okay with the Big Ten and SEC getting those two automatic bye weeks, because I feel like the distinction does have to be made at some point between the Big Ten and SEC at the top, and then the Big 12 and the ACC, and then the, you know, rest of the group of five, because obviously the Power Five is dead, with the Pac-12 dissolving, and it's not just the Power Four now, because it's the Power Two, the Big Ten and the SEC, and then the, you know, good two with the Big 12 and the ACC, and then the rest of the group of five. And I'd prefer that distinction be made with automatic buys and not more automatic bids, because of what I said before, conferences can have down years. And I think this way, the Big Ten and SEC titles would be even more valuable, because you would assume in that conference championship games in the Big Ten and SEC, both those teams are already going to the playoff. So this way it gives added value to that game and makes sure that they are gunning for those bye weeks. And I think it would also make the Big 12 and the ACC title games more meaningful, because it'd be the only way that they can guarantee their spot in the playoff. And it would also give them a home game in the first round of the playoff. And then I think the Group of Five conference championships would be just as meaningful, because, you know, they have to win their conference to be even in the college football playoff race. So I'm okay with the Big Ten and SEC getting bye weeks, but I just don't, not a fan of there being more automatic bids that aren't conference champions. I think that's the point of winning your conference, is that you kind of secure your spot to go compete in what used to be compete in a great bowl game, and now it's going to be for your chance to go compete for a national championship. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't really matter what I want, because these changes are coming, because the people that are making these changes, the athletic directors and presidents and media executives, they have one thing in the forefront of their mind when they're making these decisions, and that's money, not the quality of college football that we're getting. So they would have no problem decimating the college football regular season and ruining the sport as we know it by going to a 24, or I don't know, even a 32 team playoff, because they get more money from the playoff games, not the regular season. And they get more money when Big Ten and SEC teams, when those brands are playing in the playoff, not the rest of these small market teams. Like, they don't care that much if a Baylor is playing in a playoff game. They want to see the Penn States and the LSUs and the Ohio States and the Michigans and Alabamas. They want to see those teams in the playoff. And it just, again, I'm not vehemently against going from 12 to 14, but it just feels vast college football playoff expansion to the point where the regular season is virtually meaningless, at least for the big brands in college football. And I feel like half of that playoff being reserved for the Big Ten and SEC, I almost feel like it's inevitable with how quickly this talk of expanding to 14 teams is. And I feel like that could even snowball into the Big Ten and SEC adding even more teams and becoming even bigger super conferences, and eventually maybe even just making their own division of college football. So, like I said, it is a very slippery slope, which is why I am not a fan of this, but hopefully we are still years off from the college football that all of us know and love becoming a totally different sport. But that's my two cents on it. We can move away, because no matter how you slice it and dice it, we're going to have a terrific 2024 season. So we still got a few other headlines from around the Big Ten that I want to touch on. First off is a player change that I feel like is relevant Big Ten news. Sony Styles, Ohio State star safety, former top 10 player in his recruiting class. It was his second season last year, was all Big Ten safety. he's officially moving from safety to linebacker. And I think this is a change that I fully expected to happen. But now that it's official, I think it's really scary for this Ohio State defense. Or I should say it's scary for Big Ten offenses this year, because this Ohio State defense seems to be doing everything right. Because the talent in their secondary is just next level. So virtually an NFL quality secondary. It's like Denzel Burke would have been a first or second round pick in this year's draft. Jermaine Matthews, he was the best freshman cornerback in all of college football last year. Lathan Ransom was Ohio State's best safety last year before he got hurt in the middle of the season and missed the rest of the year. Jordan Hancock, he was a blue chip recruit who had a breakout season last year, was also Big Ten. And then they added Caleb Downs from Alabama. So they just have so much talent in the back end of that defense. Moving Sony Styles from safety to linebacker now ensures that they're going to have their best 11 players on the field at all times. He has a unique combination of size and speed and coverage skills. And it just opens up so many possibilities for Jim Knowles. They can get really creative now because they can possibly line him up on the edge, at inside linebacker, or at safety. And they could do some really creative fronts with just how loaded they are at essentially every position. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see, especially this spring, the packages that they start to create for Sony Styles and how they utilize him, because it's seeming he's almost like a Buda Baker type, that safety hybrid that came out of Clemson a few years ago. And I'm excited about this move. I think it makes Ohio State's defense a lot better. Another headline coming out of Ohio State's rival up north, Michigan, finalizing their coaching staff under Sherrone Moore. They brought in Don Martindale as defensive coordinator. Love this hire. He was an NFL defensive assistant since 2004, and he spent 11 seasons with John Harbaugh and the Ravens. And that's a pipeline that Michigan has used with great success to build their defensive coaching staff over the years under Jim Harbaugh. So it's great to see them continuing that under Sherrone Moore. And I think Martindale is going to ensure that this talented Michigan defense is going to be a top 10 unit again in 2024. They also brought in Greg Scruggs as their defensive line coach. He's a young and up-and-coming guy. He played football at Louisville, played 5 years in the NFL, and has a short coaching career so far, and he spent most of it with Luke Fickell at Cincinnati and Wisconsin last year. Not a groundbreaking hire like Martindale, but solid hire. They also let go Mike Hart, their running backs coach, who's been with the program for a really long time, is a storied running back for them. He will not be returning in 2024, in a head-turning move. And then their last hire that they made recently was Sean McGee as general manager. Now, I'm sure there's other college football general managers out there that I don't know of, but this is the first time I recall, you know, seeing college football team hiring a general manager hit the headlines. And I think it's really interesting move and something I think more teams should be utilizing. So a quote from the university for what he's going to be doing for the team. He's going to oversee all aspects of the recruiting and player personnel developments, as well as coordinate the program's NIL initiatives. So a lot of people have been saying that being a college football head coach now is more like being a CEO of the program, more so than being a head football coach, because of, I've talked in past episodes, just how insane roster management is now for college football head coaches. And it seems like this position of general manager is taking that aspect of the job off of Sherrone Moore's plate. And I talked a couple episodes ago about how I'm a little concerned about how Sherrone Moore can handle this, you know, head coaching gig and, you know, the coaching decisions he's made so far. Been some eyebrow raising, and I thought he had a bit more than he could chew with just how much college football head coaches have to do today. And I think this is going to be a huge load off of his back, and it's just taking the roster management and NIL duties off of Sherrone Moore's shoulders. Sean McGee, he has experience in football operations at the college level with Navy and at the pro level with the Bears the past couple seasons. So, guys, he knows what he's doing. And I can't speak necessarily on how effective McGee will be at improving Michigan's recruitment at NIL. I don't know the guy, but I just love that they are hiring this position and they are making this position that'll be filled every year. Because I just think it's really positive for Michigan. And I think it's something that more programs will be instituting moving forward. And another Michigan headline recently was Josh Gattis, their former offensive coordinator, coming out of the woodwork and going just berserk on Twitter over Michigan, accusing them of NCAA violations. So I'm sure a lot of people saw this pop up on Twitter and might be confused where the hell it's even coming from. So it stems from Xavier Worthy, a Texas wide receiver who broke the NFL combine record in the 40-yard dash. So Twitter was buzzing with Xavier Worthy. And if you didn't know, he was actually originally committed to Michigan. It was a long-time commit and actually wanted to enroll early at Michigan. He ended up flipping to Texas last minute on National Signing Day. Michigan fans were irate, and blue-chip recruit that was committed to him for so long, flipping to Texas at the last minute. A lot of Michigan fans blamed Josh Gattis for this, which is a big reason why he left after 2021 to go be the offensive coordinator for Miami. And seeing Xavier Worthy pop off at the combine, I think, brought up some sore feelings for some Michigan fans. And they ended up calling out Josh Gattis on Twitter again. And this time he was not quiet and went on a rampage, which included accusing Michigan of NCAA infractions. Didn't name specifically what they were. And obviously Twitter was buzzing with just everything that's been surrounding Michigan over the past few months. But to me, this is a big fat nothing. I think Josh Gattis was just sick of getting heat from Michigan fans, so he lashed back. I don't think he could be talking about something legitimate and a legitimate infraction, but listen, this is college football. A lot of teams dance around the rules. I am sure every program has a former assistant coach who knows something they did that wasn't technically legal, whether it was buying a meal for a recruit or maybe texting a player who, seeing how happy they were at their current program, something like that. And listen, you can't be naive enough to think that every single program in college football is squeaky clean and they're not doing stuff like that. That doesn't mean a huge investigation needs to be opened because of this insane competitive advantage that they are getting over their competition. And you know, I'm sure it's something small like that that Josh Gattis is talking about, and he just wanted to stoke the fire because of everything that's gone on with Michigan. He knew it'd get attention, and he wanted to get back at the Michigan fans that were talking to him on Twitter. I'm sure it was that. I don't think he has concrete evidence of major NCAA violations for Michigan. And I don't think I don't think he has the desire to bring whatever violations he's talking about to light. I don't think it's worth his time. I think it's a small storyline that'll be totally forgotten in another week or so, but felt like I had to talk about that because it definitely lit Twitter up a little bit in the past week or so. A couple other quick headlines before we dive into spring storylines. Northwestern is exploring making a makeshift stadium around their practice field while their new stadium is constructed. They're building a stadium that I'm really excited to see that's going to make the crowd a little bit more intimate and a little bit more rowdy, focus more on the fan experience, but still going to be a couple of years till they can build that. So right now they have some games scheduled for like Soldier Field, but one proposal for home games while they wait for this stadium to be built would be a makeshift stadium around their practice field that's modeled after the 16th hole at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. And that's a hole that's really infamous because it's had to be shut down on multiple occasions, had to shut down their alcohol sales on multiple occasions because of unruly crowds. And if you're watching on YouTube, I will throw up a picture of this course. If you're listening online, you should definitely, you know, look up this course if you're not familiar with it. And really what this projects to for Northwestern would be a really intimate setting of about 15, 20,000 people with fans essentially right on the field. You wouldn't be sitting like 20 yards away from the field like you are with a lot of these conglomerate stadiums. You'd be right on the field essentially, and it'd be really pretty because Northwestern's practice field is surrounded by water on three sides. And if this gets approved, if they're able to pull this off, I think it could be a really special college football environment and really one of the more unique venues that we would see in college football, almost bringing like a kind of small town college basketball environment to college football, to major college football, to seeing a brand like Ohio State, Penn State playing in a little backyard stadium. That would be really cool. So we'll see if they can pull that off. That would be really cool. Bouncing over to USC, because Johnny Manziel made headlines earlier this week talking, you know, about how he is not going to be joining the Heisman ceremony until Reggie Bush gets his Heisman back. So did a little research into this and to see maybe, because I think everyone would love to see Reggie Bush get his Heisman back. But it turns out Reggie Bush having to give up his Heisman, that sanction was attached to an institutional penalty to USC because they were charged with lack of institutional control. So that means in order for Reggie Bush to get his Heisman back, the NCAA would have to go back and reevaluate USC's penalties as a program and overturn that ruling, which would also mean giving back USC some wins because they had some wins vacated. They also had a lot of scholarships taken away, so it'd be interesting to see if they're able to do any retro action on that. But knowing how slow the NCAA works and the fact that there isn't much incentive for them to give this back to Reggie Bush, because I think everyone knows that the NCAA does not care about their public perception at all. With that in mind, I think it's really hard to imagine the NCAA going back down this path and reinvestigating USC for what they did 15, 20 years ago. Now, if all former Heisman Trophy winners were to band together and say, we won't go to the ceremony until Reggie Bush gets his Heisman back, that could spark something from the NCAA, because that would be a really tough look on national television, there being no past winners at the ceremony. But I really doubt that'll happen, because you know, that would involve convincing guys from all the way back to Archie Griffin to Tim Tebow, guys who you're asking to skip something that has so much tradition over one guy that they may or may not even have a relationship with. And I know a lot of these guys cherish the Heisman Trophy because it's the pinnacle of their career for a lot of players. I have a hard time thinking that a lot of college Heisman Trophy winners would follow Johnny Manziel in this suit. Respect him for what he's doing. I just don't personally believe that it's going to lead to anything. I think Reggie Bush is going to have to live without his Heisman Trophy. And last little headline to touch on, UCLA finishing out their coaching staff hired Ted White as their quarterback coach. So he did not work in 2023. He was the Texans quarterback coach in 2022. And before that, he coached a lot really at the FCS and a lot of HBCUs. He went to Howard and played quarterback there, is actually Howard's all-time leading passer. He did play 5 seasons in the NFL. And so he's going to be managing that quarterback competition that UCLA has this year, replacing Dante Moore. Looks like it'll be between Ethan Garbers and Colin Schley. Garbers is a 5th year, Schley a 6th year. Garbers actually a former blue chip recruit who just hasn't seen the field much. That's an underrated quarterback battle. And Ted White, just a name I wasn't familiar with, going to be in charge of that battle. But that's about it for news across college football. Gonna now dive into spring storylines. So if this is your first time watching this, we're gonna go through 6 teams in the Big Ten. We're doing this in 3 parts, so this is the second batch. And it's just the main storyline. Whether you're watching, trying to keep up with every team in the Big Ten throughout the spring, or just your team, this is really what to keep an eye on as you're watching spring practice, reading articles, checking your Twitter feed, and watching the spring game. This is the one thing that I think is really going to determine how successful these teams will be in 2024. So just something to keep an eye on. And the first team we'll talk about today is the Purdue Boilermakers, entering year 2 under Ryan Walters. And just to be blunt, I think this is going to be another growth year for Purdue. I think 6 wins is honestly their ceiling, because they just, again, for a second straight year, have to replace so much on both sides of the ball, and they have a really difficult schedule. Features games like Notre Dame, Oregon State, Oregon, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Penn State, Ohio State, Nebraska. All of those are losable games if we're being realistic. So I'm in 2024 as a whole for Purdue, I'm really looking for signs that this team is developing. Young guys are improving. I'm seeing more knowledge of that hybrid 3-4 defense that Ryan Walters runs, and everyone's knowing their assignments a little bit better. Looking for a more balanced offense and a more succinct play calling from Graham Harrell, who struggled in his first season as Purdue's offensive coordinator. Because I still believe in Ryan Walters. I don't think year 2 is the year for him to turn it all around, but I'm just looking for signs that, yes, this program is heading in the right direction and they are bound for a bowl season and win team, maybe sniffing the top 25 at some point in the near future. And as far as this spring goes, listen, Ryan Walters is a defensive mastermind. They lose a lot on defense, but they also return guys like Kidron Jenkins, had a monster year at linebacker. Dylan Thynemann, one of the best freshmen in all of college football at safety. Yanni Karloftis, Markevious Brown. A lot of really talented guys returning on that side of the ball, despite also having to replace a lot of talent. I believe in Ryan Walters will start to get this defense headed in the right direction in year 2. I'm more focused on this offense, which is weird thinking about Purdue. Generally, it's been their offense that's really carried them over the past decade or so, and really more than that if you want to go back to the Drew Brees years. But I'm more focused on this offense because Graham Harrell had a rough year as offensive coordinator last year. A lot of Purdue fans were calling for his job at the end of the season. Ryan Walters had to step up and really reinforce his faith in him. And so I just get the sense it was good to know that Graham Harrell has a secure job going into this season, but you get the sense if the offense struggles like it did last year, he won't get a third season to try to turn things around. Ryan Walters will look for answers. And offensively, they return Hudson Card. He's a talented quarterback who had a rough go of it last year, but I think he has the tools to be a really great college quarterback. And running back Devin Mockabee, one of the Big Ten's underrated stars at the position. And they should have a much better offensive line because they were decimated with injury last year. They now return four starters and bring in a boatload of transfers, JUCO transfers, and 2024 prospects. Expect that offensive line to be a lot better, but the skill position players outside of Devin Mockabee are pretty bare as far as experience and proven talent goes. They added a couple speedsters at wide receiver from Georgia in CJ Smith and Morissette. Both of them were blue chip prospects, but haven't seen the field much at Georgia. Jamal Edrine is a transfer from FAU last year who was supposed to be an impact player, but he got hurt going into fall camp, so he's healthy. And they bring in five guys in the 2024 class. And then there's at tight end, they have Max Clair. He had 22 catches as the backup tight end last year. But that's it. I just listed off the kind of top guys that they're looking at as far as pass catchers, the skill positions go. So I think this offense is really going to come down to Hudson Card's development and can he get the most out of these wide receivers? And also Graham Harrell's development as a play caller and his ability to, like I said with Hudson Card, get the most out of these guys because there is some raw athleticism there, but not a lot of proven production. So this spring for Purdue, I'm really watching the pace of this offense. I'm seeing, trying to see develop from Hudson Card, and I'm trying to see how he meshes with his new cast of receivers. And when we get to that spring game, I'm looking for really how Graham Harrell is calling plays and if he's able to get this offense into some sort of rhythm, because that was a big problem with them last year. They didn't go on many succinct long drives where they're going on 8, 10, 12 plays drives. They struggled that they had a lot of three and outs and they had to rely on the big explosive play in order to move the ball way too much. There was a lot to improve on that offensive side of the ball, and I'm really keying in there. Second, we're going to move over to Purdue's rival, Indiana Hoosiers. Kurt Cignetti coming in from JMU in his first season. He has his work cut out for him trying to turn Indiana around. I've been on record in past episodes saying that Indiana is the hardest Power Conference football program to build a winning program at. And you know, Kurt Cignetti, he has his work cut out for him. But Indiana does have some pieces that provide optimism heading into 2024. Their offensive line seems to have already solidified five starters, thanks to some really solid transfer pickups. 120 career starts across those five guys that project to start next year. The key to a good offense is always an offensive line, so that's a good sign for Indiana heading into next season. They have a really talented wide receiver room with guys like Donovan McCulley coming back. He had a great season last year. Elijah Surratt, Miles Cross, both experienced multi-year starters who transfer into Indiana. And then they bring in Curtis Rourke at quarterback, three-year starter at Ohio, MAC Offensive Player of the Year in 2022, won 20 games over the past two seasons. He's another kind of bona fide winner. But honestly, a lot of this offense is elevated compared to 2023. But Kurt Cignetti is a defensive guy. He doesn't have a signature defensive scheme. He tailors his defense around his personnel, which I love when, you know, coordinators are able to do that. The defensive line should be better with almost everyone coming back. And the linebacker room got a huge boost with three new transfers who are immediately going to, you know, contend for starting positions. So that defensive front also looks like it could improve from last year, despite losing some guys like Andre Carter and Aaron Casey, to the NFL. I'm more concerned about this secondary, and I'm really keeping my eyes on this pass defense in the spring, because if Indiana is going to surprise some people in 2024, maybe get to a bowl game and get this turnaround started ahead of schedule, it will be because of their defense. And they can't win if they don't have some guys step up in the pass defense, because there is not a whole lot of experience to lean on. And I think they're going to get a good test this spring because they do have a veteran quarterback they're going up against with Curtis Rourke. And like I mentioned, a talented and deep receiver room. So I think it'll be a good opportunity to see how good this pass defense really can be. I'm also going to keep my eye on Taven Jackson, who returns at quarterback, and Curtis Rourke, because that is the assumption is Curtis Rourke will still step in into that starting role, but it'll still be a quarterback competition. So, interested to see if Taven Jackson, former four-star guy who came in from Tennessee last year, if he can maybe push Curtis Rourke a little bit and show some of that talent that he was, you know, had IU fans excited last season. So obviously going to keep an eye on that quarterback competition as well, because they're going to have to score points if they want to turn this thing around. Kurt Cignetti, he has his work cut out for him. But Indiana does have some pieces that provide optimism heading into 2024. Their offensive line seems to have already solidified five starters, thanks to some really solid transfer pickups. 120 career starts across those five guys that project to start next year. The key to a good offense is always an offensive line, so that's a good sign for Indiana heading into next season. They have a really talented wide receiver room with guys like Donovan McCulley coming back. He had a great season last year. Elijah Surratt, Miles Cross, both experienced multi-year starters who transfer into Indiana. And then they bring in Curtis Rourke at quarterback, three-year starter at Ohio, MAC Offensive Player of the Year in 2022, won 20 games over the past two seasons. He's another kind of bona fide winner. But honestly, a lot of this offense is elevated compared to 2023. But Kurt Cignetti is a defensive guy. He doesn't have a signature defensive scheme. He tailors his defense around his personnel, which I love when, you know, coordinators are able to do that. The defensive line should be better with almost everyone coming back. And the linebacker room got a huge boost with three new transfers who are immediately going to, you know, contend for starting positions. So that defensive front also looks like it could improve from last year, despite losing some guys like Andre Carter and Aaron Casey, to the NFL. I'm more concerned about this secondary, and I'm really keeping my eyes on this pass defense in the spring, because if Indiana is going to surprise some people in 2024, maybe get to a bowl game and get this turnaround started ahead of schedule, it will be because of their defense. And they can't win if they don't have some guys step up in the pass defense, because there is not a whole lot of experience to lean on. And I think they're going to get a good test this spring because they do have a veteran quarterback they're going up against with Curtis Rourke. And like I mentioned, a talented and deep receiver room. So I think it'll be a good opportunity to see how good this pass defense really can be. I'm also going to keep my eye on Taven Jackson, who returns at quarterback, and Curtis Rourke, because that is the assumption is Curtis Rourke will still step in into that starting role, but it'll still be a quarterback competition. So, interested to see if Taven Jackson, former four-star guy who came in from Tennessee last year, if he can maybe push Curtis Rourke a little bit and show some of that talent that he was, you know, had IU fans excited last season. So obviously going to keep an eye on that quarterback competition as well, because they're going to have to score points if they want to turn this thing around. Cignetti's a defensive guy. I'm more concerned about that secondary than anything. Number three for the Big Ten spring storyline is going to look at the Washington Huskies coming off of that national championship appearance. And I love the hire of Jed Fish too, coming over from Arizona, but he also has his work cut out for him next season. I think Washington has a really bright future, but might come at the expense of some early success, because they have to replace 19 starters on offense and defense. And they brought in some guys that could make Washington maybe sneaky good next season. Will Rogers is a longtime starter at Mississippi State who transfers over. Jonah Coleman, he transfers over from Arizona after putting up over 1,200 total yards at running back last year. And Jeremiah Hunter Hilton, the great receiver from Cal, he had 122 catches over the past two seasons. He also comes in. Washington's going to have a great linebacker trio. Afonso Tuputuala. Wow, I'm just butchering that. We're going to pretend that did not happen. But Brian Parham and Carson Bruner as well. I guess just take my word for it. Washington's going to have a really good linebacker trio next year. And they did have their star cornerback transfer to Oregon, but Elijah Jackson, he played really well against Texas, and he's going to return, could step up into that lockdown cornerback role. So there are, you know, pieces to be excited about with Washington, but none of that's going to matter if this offensive line doesn't grow up fast and have some of these young guys play way beyond their years, because that is a position that's looking really bare bones, because they lost all five starters from last year and their top backup and their entire offensive line group coming into 2024 has six career starts. And at least three of their starters will be true freshmen or redshirt freshmen unless they pick up some more transfers in the spring. And so I think a lot of Washington fans are hoping that'll be the case, and I'm sure they can get a guy or two, but no matter who they get, this is going to be an inexperienced offensive line with true freshmen playing key roles. And that's a scary proposition playing in the Big Ten with all these great defensive fronts we have. So it's not sexy to try to stare at the line of scrimmage throughout spring practice or during the spring game, but Washington fans really should not concern themselves with anywhere else but the offensive line. And it won't be pretty during the spring. It might be tough to watch that offensive line get abused, but it's the sole position group that will determine if Washington can win 7 or 8 games, maybe sneak into the top 25 and have a really nice season, or if it'll be disastrous and they'll miss out on the postseason altogether, because I think both are on the table and it's entirely dependent on this offensive line. Next, we're going to switch all the way over to the East Coast and talk about Rutgers. And I've been on record talking about how excited I am about this Rutgers roster. I think they have a top 25 roster top to bottom, and people are assuming last year was a nice story for Rutgers, and their win total is set back around 5 right now for the 2024 projections. But I think it's a pretty good bet that they are going to make a bowl game again. But similar to Washington, there's only one position group that I think Rutgers fans should be concerning themselves with. And this is a little bit more fun to watch. It's the quarterback position, easily. And they return essentially every single starter from last year, what to expect out of all those guys. And they have a really good roster. And it's just the quarterback position that's really a question mark for them. Gavin Wimsatt was atrocious last year, to say the least. He's good with his legs, but he's a sub 50% passer. He has on his career, he's a negative touchdown to interception ratio. He has erratic accuracy, is a poor decision maker, and really doesn't have much to his game to really hang his hat on, at least from what he's shown us so far. And they bring in Ethan Calliope-Manis, who I've talked about his struggles at Minnesota last year. He went 5-7 with them, completed 53% of his passes for 1,800 yards, 14 touchdowns, and 9 interceptions. So slightly better than Gavin Wimsatt, but he was also throwing to a much more talented group of pass catchers. And he has a huge arm. Like, he can throw the... I wouldn't be surprised if he could throw the ball close to 80 yards. But he's, like Gavin Wimsatt, just inaccurate and prone to bad decisions. I guess one area of hope, or one thing that can allow Rutgers fans to hold out hope that they can get some competent quarterback play this year, is that both these guys, Gavin Wimsatt and Ethan Calliope-Manis, were both handed the starting jobs last year. And they didn't have to beat out any real legitimate competition. So I think it's easy to get a little complacent and hard to really improve your game if you're just battling yourself every day in practice and there's no one kind of sneaking on your back and knocking on that door trying to take your job away. And I think these guys will make each other better. They're not inherently great quarterbacks, and I don't think we're going to see an all Big Ten season out of either of them in their careers. Having legitimate competition, I think, will bring out the best in some people, and I think one of these quarterbacks will get a lot better. And at least that's my hope. Yeah, I would love to see Rutgers be good next season. I would hate to see a great roster be ruined because of poor quarterback play again. And these quarterbacks, they also have resources at their disposal, which Wimsatt didn't have last year. They have all Big Ten running back Kyle Manungai. He's going to take a big load off of that passing game. They return all 5 starters on the offensive line, including future NFL starter, quote me on that, Holland Pierce at tackle. I think he's going to be a stud in the NFL when he gets there. And their pass catchers are more robust than last year. They add FCS All-American Demir Miller. They add 2024 top 300 recruit Antonio White. He's an early enrollee. You'll see him in the spring. And they also return Chris Long, who was lost for the season in the first game last year. And then they also return Christian Dremel, who led the team in catches, yards, and touchdowns last year. This offense is much more beefed up than it was last year. Excuses for the quarterback play, but Scarlet Knight fans, you don't have to worry about anything but the quarterback position this spring. If you can see some improvement there, it could be a really exciting season in 2024. And 5th, we're going to bounce back over to the West Coast, talk about USC real quick. They bring in new defensive coordinator De'Anton Lynn from UCLA. Talked about last episode how excited I am for him, and I think he's going to be a big reason why USC will exceed expectations next season. But like a lot of these coaches I've talked about, he also has his work cut out for him. He's in charge of turning around what's been one of the worst defenses in the power conferences over the past 3 seasons. And not only that, but they've gotten progressively worse year over year. So I am really excited to see how quarterback Miller Moss develops on the offensive side of the ball and how some of these young, talented skill position players play in expanded roles like running back Quinton Joyner Wide receivers Deuce Robinson and Zachariah Branch, all former five-star guys, all ridiculous athletes who have performed well in their kind of limited snaps, and they're all stepping into starting roles now. So excited to see how this new generation of Trojans performs. But these are all talented guys. They've all showed flashes before in their career, and I think you can talk about how Lincoln Riley has underperformed all you want. To his credit, he's always got a good offense, so I'm not too concerned about that side of the ball. It'll be fun to see how these guys progress, but I think no matter what, USC should have at minimum an above-average offense next year. My attention is really going to be on that defensive side of the ball with DeAnton Lynn, in particular to the defensive line, because Alex Grinch is beyond me why this was his philosophy, but he actually preferred smaller defensive lines so he could have versatile guys who could rush the passer or drop back into coverage and be like a legitimate, you know, pass coverage threat. I guess that would be my thought in his wanting a small defensive line, but it never worked out. It was a disaster. Their defensive line was constantly pushed around. They could never get a consistent rush on the pass rush. They couldn't set an edge. And their inability to get after the passer just exploited missed assignments and poor fundamentals in the back end of that defense. So there were a lot of issues with USC's defense, but having a defensive line that was just as porous as theirs really just amplified everything else that was wrong with their defense. So priority number one for DeAnton Lynn is beefing up that defensive line. He brings in veterans Nate Clifton from Vanderbilt and Isaiah Rakes from A&M. Both former highly rated recruits. Anthony Lucas is a former five-star guy who has the size that DeAnton Lynn is really looking for. And Bear Alexander returns at defensive tackle. He's 6'3", 300 pounds. So those are all guys to watch throughout the spring. And I'm just interested to see how this defensive line evolves and if they can be a force. And I think you will be able to count on fewer blown assignments in the back end of this defense. I think you can count on better overall fundamentals and technique under Lynn. I think that's a given. So if he can, whether or not he can turn this from a horrible defense into an okay defense or turn it into a formidable unit will depend on this defensive line and how they perform and how they evolve throughout this offseason. So USC, I'm definitely keying in on that defensive line. And last but not least, we're going to bounce up to the Great Lakes, Minnesota Golden Gophers. So they had a disappointing season in 2023, to say the least. I think a lot of Minnesota fans were thinking Big Ten West title. Instead, they went 5-7 in the regular season and got gifted a kind of bogus bowl game that they wanted to get to 6 wins. But they do return a lot of production. 4 starters on the offensive line, one of the best freshmen in all of college football. I've said that about a few guys, but there were a lot of talented freshmen last year. But Darius Taylor, one of the best freshman running backs in the country last year. Wide receiver Daniel Jackson, who I think is one of the most underrated receivers in the country. And then they only lose 2 starters on the defensive side of the ball. And pretty much every single projected starter and key contributor on that side of the ball is in their 4th year or higher. So there's a lot of experience on the defensive side of the ball for Minnesota. And I think their defense was dismal last year. I think it should improve a lot next year and kind of get back to more what we've been used to seeing under PJ Fleck. And I honestly think that the Gophers are being slept on this offseason. Their win over under was 4.5 last time I checked, which is just, considering how solid Minnesota has been over the past decade, that is almost unfathomable for them to be that low. And I think there are a lot of reasons to believe that Minnesota can turn it around and get back to playing the football that we're used to seeing under PJ Fleck, but biggest question mark is easily the quarterback position, because I mentioned it before, Ethan Calliope-Manis was a disaster last season in relief of Tanner Morgan, who graduated after being at the school for 6 years. And he didn't really have anyone to compete with, and now he's gone. And the quarterback job all but belongs to transfer Max Brosmer, because his only competition is, this is another guy I'm probably going to butcher the name of, Max Shikanjanski. He's a 2-star from the 2023 class. He was 165 pounds coming out of high school. Definitely not in any shape to be taking hits from Big Ten defensive linemen. And his other competition will be Drake Lindsey, who's a 3-star in this 2024 class. He isn't an early enrollee, so you'll get a chance to see him in the spring. But the assumption is Max Brosmer will be Minnesota's starting quarterback next year. He's entering his 6th season, transfers from New Hampshire out of the FCS. Over the last two seasons, he started 24 games. He's gone 17-7 with 63% completion, nearly 7,000 yards, 56 touchdowns, 14 interceptions, only about 7.5 yards an attempt, which is low for the college level, but all in all, pretty impressive numbers, even for the FCS level. What really stands out to me is that great touchdown to interception ratio. He's won a lot of games for a program that isn't traditionally an FCS power. He actually got them into the FCS playoff a couple years ago, and he has been consistently one of the most prolific passers in Division I AA over the past two seasons. So obviously it is a big step up going from playing South Dakota State to playing Ohio State and Michigan and Oregon. But I think you can, at the very least, rely on him to be a good leader for this locker room, be a good decision maker, know where to get the ball out, and make sure the ball gets out on time, and someone who can have at least reliable accuracy within 20 yards of the line of scrimmage. And if that's all he is next year, that'll still be a big step up from last year. But I'm curious, how much can he elevate this offense? Can he be a threat with his legs? Can he push the ball downfield? And can he stay upright against these great Big Ten defenses that he's going to be playing? Those are the questions I'm really looking for in the spring. And maybe what could be disastrous if he really struggles and all of a sudden you're staring down the barrel of another season of struggling to complete 50% of your passes. Because if that's the case, Minnesota has some pieces here. I think they could surprise a lot of people, but if they don't get improved quarterback play, the rest of the roster won't really matter. It's going to be 6 wins at best for them next year. So a lot of eyes on Max Brosmer coming out of Minnesota next year. And that'll do it for this episode of the Big Ten Blitz, wrapping up part two of Big Ten Spring Storylines. We're going to be getting another episode out to you very quickly. Going to get some more coverage of the NFL draft because we have some Big Ten prospects who are making major moves. And wrap up, bring Big Ten Spring Storylines so you know what to look for the rest of these teams. But that's all coming soon. Appreciate you all hanging in there with me. Make sure you can like and subscribe us wherever you're listening to us right now. Check out our website, thefloorslap.com. You can check us out on Twitter, at thefloorslap. And with March Madness coming around the corner, there's a lot of content that Jordan is pumping out, and he's going to make sure that everyone knows everything there is to know heading into March Madness. So lots of great things coming up from the Floor Slap. Thanks for listening to the Big Ten Blitz college football podcast. I've been your host, Sean, and I'll catch you here next time.